This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful handcrafted agricultural journal. Subscribe today at southernfarmandgarden.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Rajat Parr, educator, sommelier, and winemaker. We'll talk to Raj about his wine projects, Burgundy, and other exciting wines. We'll also taste a Evening Land La Source 2014 Pinot Noir. I'm your host, Sam Ben-Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. With a long career in wine, Rajat Parr has been called one of the most celebrated sommeliers in the world. He has shifted his expertise and energy towards ownership and winemaking at Sandy, Domaine de la Cote, and Seven Springs, also known as Evening Land. Raj also received a James Beard Award for his book, Secrets of the Sommelier, How to Think and Drink Like the World's Top Wine Professionals. Welcome to the show, Raj.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, what I want you to do is, you have a long, deep background in wine and hospitality. I want you to tell our audience a little about how you got to where you are today, which right now is basically winemaking and having your own labels. But how did we get here?
So I grew up in India, in Calcutta. And when I was a kid, I loved food, so always in the kitchen with my mom. I spent some time with my cousins who had restaurants in New Delhi, and since I was 10 years old, I knew that I wanted to be in the restaurant business, and I wanted to be a chef. So that took me to a hotel school in India, and then I ended up in the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, in Hyde Park, New York. Moved to New York, upstate New York.
And did you do the whole program at CIA?
Yeah, whole 2 years.
No focus towards wine?
No, it was just on cooking, and that was in 94, and then I think in 96, we had a wine component to the course, and I fell in love with wine. I just kept studying and reading, and when I graduated, I was like, I got to work in restaurants and I got to learn wine. And back then, 96, there weren't that many sommeliers, especially young sommeliers. They were mostly all, you know, professionals and older guys.
I had Kevin Zraley on months ago, and he said when he was working back in the day, which is even before, there were six sommeliers in New York. He said, now you go into a restaurant and there's six sommeliers.
Yeah.
So you're right about that.
Yeah, so I just moved across the country and went to work with Larry Stone.
Did you move because the opportunity was there?
No, or? I just moved because I wanted to study under Larry Stone.
So you were drawn to Larry.
Yeah, and I started as a busboy, a food runner, and slowly made my way up to assistant sommelier. And after that, I worked in few restaurants. I met Michael Mina, worked with Michael Mina.
So Larry took you under his wing.
Yep.
Larry realized you were passionate, even though you were a busboy, you probably persevered a little, right?
Yeah, for sure. No, I was always there, always asking questions and following him around and reading. And, you know, back then there was no Google.
Right. And Larry out west was one of the handful of guys that the guy.
He was the guy on the west coast of San Francisco. So that's where I started. Then I worked in a few restaurants, worked with Michael Mina, became his wine director, worked with him for 13 years.
By the time you got to Michael, he already was up and established with a reputation and critical acclaim, right?
Yeah. I started working at Aqua with him, and then right after that, he left and started his own company, and that's how I started working with him.
Right.
And that was with zero restaurants. And I think when I left, there was 20 plus restaurants.
Wow.
I don't know how many. That's a lot now.
And you were, when you were there, you, like you said, you elevated to wine director. You oversaw the program for the group.
Yeah. Also the program, built many of the programs, training, education.
I don't want to spend too much time, but what was the skew? Did you have to serve a lot of California wines because of proximity? Did you bring in a passion of yours? What was the cellar? Because I know you're a Burgundy guy, and we're going to talk about that.
Yeah, no, in my early career, there was not a whole lot of California wine. It was mostly Burgundy, Rhone, and Champagne. So that continued in the wine list for... Of course, you have to have California wine because you're in California.
And it started growing while you were moving, you know, through the years in the business.
Right. I mean, there was Burgundy around in San Francisco, but I think when I got there, I was so excited. And there was so much available back then, and it was not expensive.
Right.
You could buy anything you want. So
just the story now.
Now it's quite different.
So you were instrumental in getting Burgundy out to the masses through the restaurants and all that.
Yeah, there are a bunch of us, yeah. But
right.
Yeah,
I'm
for
not
sure.
Saying single-handedly.
Yeah. No, it was. I think it was a passion. Larry had a big passion for Burgundy,
that was my question. You developed an early affection for Burgundy.
Oh, very early. I went straight to Burgundy. My epiphany wine was a Burgundy, so I never really went towards Bordeaux. It was Burgundy from day one.
So I was going to ask you who influenced you, and I guess Larry.
Yeah.
And why Burgundy? I mean, it was something you had put your mind to. I mean, why wasn't it Bordeaux, or you were attracted to the wine, the style?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of reasons. Once I ended up in Beaune by mistake. I took a wrong train and I ended up in
Beaune.
Where
were you going?
And I was going to Dijon. I couldn't find a hotel room. I said, okay, next town. Someone said, the next town has a hotel you can stay in. So the next town was Beaune. So that was in...
Bingo.
That was in 96.
Ground zero.
So, and I had no idea this place made wine. So I just stayed there the night. And next day I came back to Paris. And then I kind of, tasted a wine with Larry. He was sitting in the bar. See, he gave wine, tasted somebody else. And I picked the glass up. I'm like, wow, this is like... This is crazy. How can wine smell like this? And
but you tell a story a lot about the first time you tried wine. You were about 20, and you tried it with an uncle.
Oh yes.
And in my research, I think it was a Bordeaux.
Yeah, it was.
Didn't hit. Was it a good wine or?
No,
it didn't hit you the way Burgundy did a little later on.
Yeah,
right?
That was maybe my first real
taste
wine, and I think I was 20, and I was in England and my uncle was drinking wine, and I didn't really drink wine. I know I had wine. I didn't like drink much alcohol, so I'm like, I'll taste it. And I taste it. I'm like, wow, this is crazy. It's made from grapes. And so it's like you're a kid. You're like, it's funny. And
you started putting everything together.
Yeah, and then
it's an agricultural product.
Yeah, it's there's not that many fruits that produce something so ethereal.
Right, and so diverse. All right, so let's talk about Burgundy. We know. Because I want you to help me here, and I want you to help my listeners. We know Burgundy could be expensive.
Yeah.
We know it's rare. We know it's sought after. There's a million stories about it. I wouldn't say it's almost impossible for the average guy to drink, but like I said, it's expensive and rare. So tell my listeners the best way to drink Burgundy on a budget.
Yeah.
How do you drink Burgundy?
First of all, it's Burgundy, it's white Burgundy, it's Chardonnay, red Burgundy, it's Pinot Noir. So that's the basic.
Okay.
And
there's
of course,
your grapes.
Yeah, the simple is white is one grape, red is Pinot Noir. So it's very simple. Of course, you can get really geeky and you can get really expensive real quick, but there's still a lot of a good drinkable wines like Bourgogne, Bourgogne Rouge. Bourgogne means Burgundy.
So Bourgogne. Right.
So that means Burgundy in French.
Okay.
And that's the appellation wine. That's like a generic wine from the area. And that's always quite affordable. You can buy a bottle of Bourgogne for...
And do the better producers make Bourgogne?
I mean, not all, but many of the top producers...
I don't want to say cheap, but it's their more inexpensive or lower-priced wine.
I mean, it's basically in Burgundy... they've classified all the vineyards. So every vineyard has a classification of either the top Grand Cru or Premier Cru or according to the village they're located in. Bourgogne is a kind of overarching major appellation wine. So And I think that you can find some delicious Borgogna for $30, $40.
You're looking at $30, $40 range to get into Burgundy, to get into good stuff. Can I back you against the wall a little? Can you think of a couple of producers that are doing a good job on the Pinot?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, Mouni Regiborg from One Romane. They are a little bit more expensive than that, but top Borgogna Rouge, of course. Christophe Roumier makes a pretty delicious...
Roumier, R-O-U-M-I-E-R.
Yeah, that's probably harder to get because he makes so little. There's...
give me something more common.
Jean-Marc Rouleau, maybe.
R-O-U-L-O-T.
Yeah.
Okay.
Borgogna. Or, you know, even if you find a Borgogna from a bigger house, like a négociant like Joseph Drouin. Louis Jadot, right. Bouchard.
Right.
You know, those are more available.
More available and priced, you know, in that 30. But your opinion, you know, is highly valuable. That stuff is good too. I mean,
absolutely. Okay. It's really good for whites. I mean, I think the really good value is still Lion Chablis. You know, Chablis is the northernmost region. It's they make Chardonnay there mostly.
So Chablis is the region.
Chablis
Chardonnay is the grape.
Yeah.
Right?
And
you could get value price Chablis, which is white Burgundy.
Exactly. It's white Burgundy. It's just different soil there. And it's a wine of texture and really delicious. It's high acid. It's very fresh.
Good food
and
wine.
Great with shellfish and, you know.
Right.
You can have oysters or, you know, lobster. It depends on how heavy
seafood.
The wine. Yeah, it's a really good value. That you can easily get a top wine from, you know.
So traditionally, and in general with wines, Burgundy may buck that trend, but whites tend to be cheaper than a lot of their red counterparts.
Correct.
Can you get Chablis... You know, in the $20, $30, $40
range,
that's a good representation.
Yeah, yeah, you can get Chablis under $30. It's definitely it's even I personally drink a lot of Chablis because you know
it's just a good go-to wine.
It's a good Tuesday night wine.
And same deal. There's a lot of well-known winemakers, wineries.
Yeah,
that
I mean,
make some value-priced Chablis.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a. Not that many producers from the Côte d'Or, which is the major part of Burgundy, make Chablis. But you know, again, Drouin has a great Chablis, or Brocard.
B-R-O-C-A-R-D, right?
Yeah, they make a good
so Brocard's
good Chablis. So you know, it's a very special place, and it makes a very unique wine. You can't compare Chardonnay from Chablis with anywhere else. It's just very, very unique.
So what you're saying is if you take white wine, you take Chardonnay, you take it from Chablis, in your mind, that's the best representation of white Chardonnay wine.
Yeah, and that's stuff. Of course, if someone likes to drink a rich, buttery, oaky wine...
Give them Kendall Jackson or whatever.
So
I know.
Chablis is not the way to go.
Right.
But if you like something which is crisp and fresh and you want to have a classic Chardonnay from Burgundy, it's a really good place to to buy wine from, for sure.
One last question. You alluded earlier, Burgundy has different regions and crews and all of that. On the Bourguignon and the Chablis, is it similar? Or it's basically categorized?
So, yeah, so you can have a Bourgogne also in Chablis, but you have Chablis... You have Premier Cru and then Grand Cru.
Okay,
so
we're talking the lower end stuff.
Yeah, so but then there's a specific Cru. Of course, when you go into single parcel wines and classified wines, then of course it gets
that's less likely to be the lower value wine.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So usually just an Appellation wine, like a Bourgogne Blanc or Bourgogne Rouge, so red Burgundy, white Burgundy, Appellation wine. Those are and there are some other small regions just south of Burgundy in the Côte Chalonnais, and then of course in the Mâcon, which is the southern
Macon, right?
Which is
producing some good white wine.
It's a southern part of Burgundy. It's just north of Beaujolais, which is also
now Beaujolais is part of Burgundy,
correct?
But we don't talk about Beaujolais really as a Burgundy.
Yes, as a matter of fact, you can actually call a, if you call a Bourgogne Rouge, you can use the Gamay in there also.
Okay. And so, I know you make one Gamay, right?
Yeah. A Gamay is, I mean, I think maybe the most delicious grape in the whole world.
We'll talk later when we get to your wines. So there's Burgundy, and then there are regions that surround it, like Mâcon and Beaujolais, that are producing some good wines, too, that are accessible.
Yeah.
All right, so enough of Burgundy. My head's spinning. but let's stay with Burgundy for a second, because one of the reasons you're in town, because Raj is a West Coast-based guy, is there's an event going on that is sort of the Mac Daddy of Burgundy events. It's an event called La Paulée, and it was founded by Daniel Jonas, who has been on the show and a friend of Raj. And I think you could do a better job explaining at this point, you know, what La Paulée is and the connection to Burgundy.
Yeah, so La Paulée is a harvest, end of harvest celebration. It started in the village of Merceau, and every year after harvest in November, all the Merceau producers get together and have a big party. I mean, this is like 700-800 people in one old, it's a chateau in Merceau, and only Merceau producers can participate. Of course, they can invite other producers, right. All the other Burgundy
but
producers.
The core is them. Yeah.
But it's hosted in Merceau by the Merceau producers. And so Daniel Jonas took the same spirit of the La Paulée de Merceau and made an event, which is called La Paulée de New York, and then La Paulée de San Francisco. So every other year happens, and then he invites a lot of producers, the top producers, and then has a week-long, it's just like tastings and lunches and dinners and seminars, and then you finish on a Saturday night with this great big party, and everyone brings bottles. And
where is that this year?
It's a new location this year.
Oh. Yeah, it is. We'll get to it later. But it's at all restaurants. There's Burgundy Week that participate.
Oh, yeah.
There's tastings with famous winemakers that come in from France.
Oh, yeah, tastings and seminars. And then there's Burgundy Week. So all the top restaurants in New York City have, pour different Burgundies by their glass. It's really a huge celebration of Burgundy.
But I have a question a little off topic, but we'll get back to it. So you're pretty much in town to participate in a lot of that.
Yeah.
And I follow you on Instagram, but last night you were like at the most amazing Cornasse tasting. How does that fit into La Paulée?
No, we just had a bunch of us were in the Rhone last week.
Right, I saw that trip.
So we were in the Rhone, and we all love Syrah, of course. And we had organized this like a kind of just a tasting among dinner for friends late at night. So it wasn't part of any Burgundy festival, but it was just it just happened because we all on town at the same time.
Right.
Just to
it was a perfect time to
open
do
some bottles. Yeah,
you just got back from that trip to France.
Yeah,
and you were in more than the Rhone region, right?
Yeah, I'm writing a book.
I was going to say you were there for a reason. Tell me a little about the book. When? What?
Yes. So me and Jordan McKay, my good friend and co-author,
wrote the other book with
the Last Secret Sommelier book with. We are writing a book called The Atlas of Taste. And in the book, we're trying to discuss how all the classic wines of the world, why they taste the way they taste. So we've been all over Europe.
So you go backwards.
Yeah, so exactly.
To the sites the wineries.
It starts in the vineyard, and then we taste the wine, and then we try to kind of figure out and explain to our readers why does Chambon Muzini taste like that? Why does Chinon taste like it is? Why does Rioja taste like what it is? What the grape is, what the soil is, and try to kind of.
So the most obvious things are the soil is so diverse, the grape type.
Yeah, it's soil.
But when you get to Burgundy, everybody's doing Pinot, but the diversity of sites, that's where it gets interesting.
Exactly.
Right?
We're not going to get crazy geeky because you could go really deep on this, but.
Right.
Something which people can open one book and say, okay, I want to see, what's the grape or what's the soil or what's in, Ribera del Duero, what's the soil in the Mosel-Zarruber, what is in,
Now, so how many regions are you going to cover?
A lot.
You're not just doing France.
No, it's France, Italy, Spain, Germany, Austria.
Wow. How deep into it are you?
We've done all the research, almost 3 years of research.
You've been to Austria and you've been to... I remember seeing you in Germany.
So
not that long ago.
So now we are just in the process of putting it together, writing it. And
so when do you hope to get it done and get it to market?
It needs to be done by October. And
of this year?
Yeah.
Well, you're going to be busy.
Yeah, and then we are going to be published next fall.
Great. I'd love to talk to you again when the book comes out.
For sure.
That would be great. So the book is, again, called...
The Atlas of Taste.
The Atlas of Taste. Do you know Pascaline Lepelletier?
Very
well.
She's
writing a book called Dirt.
Yeah.
So she's working on that, too. All right, I want to shift over to what you do. And Raj earlier said, he had worked in hospitality and in wine. Now he's currently involved in 3 wine projects at pretty much every level. So you are making Pinot Noirs in California.
Yep.
You've really picked sites and everything. And when we get to the individual wineries, we'll talk about that. Tell me, I'm more curious, but I'm sure everyone, what's the biggest difference between California Pinot Noir and French Burgundy Pinot Noir? Is there such
huge difference?
Is it the terroir and the grape? Do you aspire to do that?
First of all, just California itself is so diverse, from starting from Anderson Valley and going down to San Rita Hills. You're talking of Sonoma Coast, Santa Cruz Mountains,
by the ocean.
Yeah,
inland,
so the one common factor in all of California is it's all maritime climate, so it's all influenced by the ocean. As we know, Pacific Ocean is quite cold, so it keeps the wind, keeps the fog, so we can grow grapes. In Burgundy, it's continental climate, so it's influenced by the latitude. So there are two major differences right there. The growing seasons are completely opposite, because it's warm in the summer in Burgundy, and it's cool in the summer on the coast of California. So it's very different. The soils are very different. There's not any soil in California which is like Burgundy, because limestone.
What's the big... All that added up creates two different types of... What's the biggest distinction? Is California brighter?
Of course, we have a lot more sun.
Okay.
And
I don't mean brighter in the sky.
No,
the wine itself, is it?
Oh, it's a little bit softer and rounder, and I won't say riper for alcohol or sweetness, but it just seems much more, it's forward drinking, much easier to drink. It doesn't have the same tannin structure, doesn't have the same, the guts is different. It's not as, it's a softer wine. They don't have the same phenolic,
Even if you brought French vines grafted, nothing would happen because the climate.
And soil, yeah.
Right.
It's completely...
So that style is going to come about, you manage it.
Yeah.
Which is a good segue into my next question, because you have a very distinct style of wine, and that came out when you and Jasmine Hirsch, who had been on the show, started an organization. Would you call it an organization?
Yeah, it was a small group, which
was called In Pursuit of Balance, IPOB.
Yeah.
And the mission statement was that wines were being made a certain way, which is fine, but you guys saw wine as being made how we're drinking how.
Yeah, there were a handful of producers who were making wine in more of a, I guess, old world style wine with, more earthy wines, more wines driven by acidity and freshness. And then the majority of California, which still does produce wine, slightly riper, slightly softer, slightly lower acidity, more fruit driven. And there were a handful of us who were thinking more about structure and acidity and kind of earthiness in wine. And we created this small organization among friends just to, just to kind of have a voice of saying, hey, there's another style in California. It's not all just, ripe and juicy and soft. There's another style. And that was just a bunch of us got together and kind of just...
And
made a bunch of noise.
You were all kindred souls, and you all have the same vision. boy, did that get attention. Let's talk about that a little. Yeah. Now everybody thought, wow, your shit doesn't smell. You know, what's wrong with what we're doing? I mean, you had to deal with that a little, right? And it grew bigger for years, more members.
Yeah, yeah. You know, of course, you know, if you ever, you know, draw a line in the sand, it's always going to be like, what are you doing? It's like, you know, it's like, and it was not an argument or fight. It's just about, this is another way.
Well, you didn't pick the fight. You just pursued the passion. It's the other side that kind of picked and said, who do you think you are? You know, is that fair?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, we didn't want to ever, you know, argue with somebody else's livelihood and business plan, because that's not what we were just trying to say. This is us, and we are doing this. Not
that's
just
all,
say
right? It wasn't like, let's do something to screw those guys. Let's get together and show other styles.
Many of my friends, you know, who we've discussed this with, and it was never intended to, you know, ever tell somebody else that they're doing the wrong thing. It was just bring attention to a few of us who were trying to, you know, because of course the press and the media was not all on our side, very few.
Right.
So, you know, and if you're only buying wine by looking at scores from wine publications, it becomes difficult, because of course all our scores are quite low compared to the riper style. So it wasn't meant to kind of, there was no fight intended, it just kind of was another style, because we didn't have the support of the press.
Now, is that because the press supported the mainstream wine business? Like, if you pick a specific thing, Wine Spectator, you know, they're doing business with all the, you know, Uber wineries and all that. That's not that much in their sight.
I mean, first of all, I have nothing against any publication.
Right, and I'm not trying to say, I'm going to retract that. I think the mainstream media looks at the business a certain way, and you were coming up with a good idea. But you did have some voices, like JonBenet.
Yeah, no.
He was right.
Yeah, JonBenet and Eric Asma. Yeah. No, that's plenty. It was not meant to be what it became.
Right.
That's the reason we ended it. Because
you had a run for about, what, 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, 6 years.
And you did tastings around the country.
Yeah, I did tastings. And
at the end, you had about how many producers?
Like 20-something, 25 or 30. Close to 30, actually.
And it just made sense. You made your... Yeah. Not made your point. You did what you intended to do.
Yeah, it was meant to be a small tasting among friends, and I think maybe it became bigger than what it should be.
Not sorry you did it.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was a great thing.
It was great doing it. It just took a lot of time and energy. And
yeah, as if you're not busy enough. Right. You know, anyway. All right, I want to segue a little towards the wines and winemaking and all of that. But in doing that, you were a sommelier, and you clarify a few things for me. You're devoting all your time to the wineries now?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
No longer, you know, consulting or beverage directing?
No,
it's a full-time job. So tell me, biggest difference between being a sommelier and now not running, you know, one winery and making wines to doing what you're doing now. It's not as if you weren't busy as a somm.
Oh, yeah. It's a humbling experience, because, you know, you put yourself out there. You know, you plant a vineyard and you make wine, and you don't know how it's going to turn out, because if you make it in a natural way without any manipulation, so you kind of leave yourself out there to be, you know, judged by whoever. So, you know, so that's what you do. We kind of produce a wine from the place and produce a wine which is in our style and in Sashi style.
Can you describe that?
Yeah, you know.
I mean, you have to, I wouldn't call it house style, but you have a vision of what your style.
Yeah, you know, I've been in restaurant business for 2 decades, so of course my early wines were all European wines. So of course all are, and Sashi Mormon, my partner, he also has been drinking mostly European wines for the last 20 years. So, of course, our style is more like that, more kind of crunchy fruit and fresh with acidity and texture and earthiness, you know, less so, you know, we don't want the wine to be too fruity, and it's not going to be like, you know,
to control the acidity,
yeah,
the alcohol. Right.
Yeah, so the wines are, you know, they tried to make it more kind of fresh and balanced, and whatever the word balance means.
So that's the style. Go back to the question. You were a sommelier, now you're a winemaker.
Yeah.
Just, you get up now and it's just a totally different...
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
What don't you miss? What do you miss?
You can control a lot when you're a sommelier because you can judge a lot of things. And here you have your own wine. You judge your own barrels. You judge your own what you do, and you're never happy with it. And
you were a hospitality guy. You like being around people and turning them on to wines and all that.
Yeah.
Now you're in some dark cellar or something.
Yeah, and I'm out still enjoying the wines. And, you know, because me and Sasha, we make the wines. We also go and show the wines. You don't really have... any sales teams or marketing team. We do it ourselves.
I'm on your mailing list. I get regular info. We'll tell people where to find stuff. But you do a lot of the sales through mailing lists and all that?
Yeah. We have a mailing list. And, of course, being in restaurant, I want the wines to be in restaurants.
Well,
and,
you know the business
in
every end. So that's a good... positive point for the winery that getting into restaurants even though you have to do it
for sure and
you have to pre-sell
and our vision is these wines, these vineyards, some we've bought and some we've planted, is going to outlive us for sure. It's not none of our wines have our names on it. It's just
right. So let's talk about that, because there's a lot to talk about. So, and correct me if I need correction, you are operating, you're the proprietor of three wineries, Sandi, which you started in around 2010?
Yeah, so 9 was the first vintage and 2010, yes.
Okay, so you're the partner proprietor there. It's a small producer focusing on select vineyards. So tell me, the distinctions of Sandi.
Yeah, so Sandi means collaboration in Sanskrit. So I, of course, grew up in India, so
right.
Hence the name. And collaboration, because it's a negociant. It's we buy all our grapes, so we don't own any vineyards under Sandi. We started that in 2009, first vintage, and we produce mostly Chardonnay. And
give me a percentage. Is it like 60-70% Chard?
Yeah, it's 70% Chardonnay.
Okay, so that's your Chard.
Yeah.
House.
Yeah, and it's focusing the main one we make is the Sandi Santa Barbara County Chardonnay. And then we have also, we're of course based in Lompoc in Santa Rita Hills. So we have a bunch of single vineyard Chardonnays from Santa Rita Hills only.
You contract almost 7, 8, 9 vineyards, right?
Yeah. We have, we make wine from the heralded Sanford Benedict vineyard, the Mount Carmel vineyard, and Bentrock, and Rita's Crown. So yes, it's a really amazing place to grow Chardonnay and to...
The styles vary that much because of the... different vineyards?
Yeah, we try to make the wine the same way, and natural acidity, ambient yeast, all that kind of good stuff,
right.
And then show what the vineyard has to express, and the wines are definitely more crunchy, probably among the highest acidity Chardonnays in the New World, in California for sure. So that's the idea, because you can make that kind of style of wine there very easily.
Right, and you said you make a few Pinots.
And we make Appalachian wine and just a little bit of some old vineyards, right. Some Pinots.
So if you want to drink good Chardonnays, Sandi is certainly a specialist.
Yeah, if you like the fresh and crunchy
right.
style
Which
Chardonnay.
We've been talking about for
yeah,
the
Yeah, yeah, that, that's
the
definitely, I like to describe the style, so it's not rich and oaky and
right.
sweet. So.
Right. So we move to Domaine de la Côte, which is based in Lompoc.
Yeah, it's also in Lompoc. So both the wines are made in the same place.
Right.
The vineyards are just 5 minutes away from where the winery is, in the wine ghetto in Lompoc. That's what it's called.
That's what it's called?
The wine ghetto. So, and these are vineyards which Sashi Mormon found, my partner.
Do you own them?
Yeah, okay. yeah. So we planted the vineyards starting in 2007, and we are still planting now. So it's all estate. It's mostly all Pinot Noir.
What makes an estate? The winery has to be on or near the vineyards, or not necessarily?
No, it's all owned. So we control all the farming. Everything happens according to us. There's no, it's managed entirely by an estate or a domain. Totally controlled from farming to bottling.
So you have multiple vineyards 40-plus acres, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we have our four major vineyards, Memorias, Bloomsfield, La Côte, and Siren's Call.
And those are the names of the wines?
Those are the names of the vineyards,
And the wines, okay. What else about those wines? They're organically grown, right?
Yeah, they're organically grown. They're virgin soils. Nothing really planted them before that. We make them in a very traditional way. They all are fermented with mostly the whole cluster, whole bunches. So we don't destem.
Explain to my listeners what that means. So the whole cluster is the grape, the stem?
Yeah, so it's like when you pick...
Maybe a leaf in there or two?
No, we don't like leaves, but when you pick the cluster, everyone's eating the grapes. If you take the whole cluster, the entire cluster, you ferment it in its entire.
The stem attachment.
Everything, yeah. So you don't take the berries off.
Right.
What
does the stem add? Tannin or what's the characteristic by doing a whole cluster?
It's not necessarily about the stem that should add the character. It's the fermentation happening inside each berry.
Okay.
That is what is more important.
But I'm stumped here because if you pulled the berries without the whole cluster, you did the whole cluster. What effect is whole cluster or what?
Because when you take the berry out of the stem,
right,
the juice comes out.
Out
of the berries.
It's intact in a way.
So it's intact. So fermentation is happening inside every berry. So you have a lot of different texture wines. It's just texture is different from whole cluster versus destem. And they both, there's no right or wrong answer. So we do mostly with whole bunches, whole cluster, and we ferment them in large concrete vats, concrete tanks, open top, and with ambient yeast and no additives. And
no oak in sight.
Yeah, we don't put any yeast, we don't put any enzyme, no nutrients. It just ferments and then... When this is done, you press it, you put it in the barrel.
So tell me the four wines. Tell me what each one is. So, give me the names again and tell me the type of wine.
Yeah, so they're all single parcels. Memorias, which is the most exposed to the ocean. It's 8 miles from the ocean. It's the windiest place where we grow grapes. And the soil is this kind of alluvial-less kind of soils. And the bedrock is diatomaceous, which is a silica-based fossil. And then right above that is Bloomsfield, which is more iron-rich clay. So wines are slightly more muscular, more spicy. And then we have La Côte, which is all shale, which is metamorphic clay.
Pretty diverse.
And that's south-facing, and that produces a very aromatic and kind of ethereal, very rose petal and red fruits. And then above that is Siren's Call, which is 2.5 acre. It's a very... small vineyard, decomposed quartz, and that produces a uniquely different wine. It's usually more tannic and quite explosive.
So you said you planted in 07?
07, yeah.
So stuff is still growing and not ready to... Is all the acreage planted and is everything ready to pick, or it's an ongoing process?
It's almost all picked, almost all planted. So a little bit left. I think by next year we'll have 65 acres all planted. Right now only 40 are producing.
Okay.
So
it's 40 acres planted producing. You have more acreage which
been planted.
Right.
And,
so that's good news.
Yeah, so, we might have even some more single parcels down the road. Because even though we planted in 07, the first vintage was 2011.
Great. All right, let's move to your third project. Evening Land, Seven Springs?
Yeah.
Okay. And if you go backwards, back to Domaine de la Côte, some of the Domaine de la Côte parcels were part of the Evening Land vineyards?
Initially they were planted under the Evening Land umbrella. And then we took it over and separated that because it's just complicated to have the same name in different places.
Right.
So, Evening Land is the mother company for Domaine de la Côte.
And that's Oregon?
Evening Land is Oregon, yeah. So now it's only Oregon because in the past there was Sonoma, there was Santa Rita. Now it's 100% Oregon, it's 100% Seven Springs, which is a very, very famous venue.
How do you pronounce it? Eola Amity Hills?
Yeah, the Appalachian.
Right.
It's called Eola Amity Hills in the Willamette Valley.
And you're making predominantly Pinot there? Or
Pinot Noir, Chardonnay.
And a little Gamay.
And a little bit of Gamay.
Right.
Yeah.
So how many wines are you making?
We have, right now we have 7 wines from the estate. And
your first outlier, a Gamay, right?
Yeah.
Tell me why and how that came about.
So the Gamay has been there since 1988. That was the first vineyard of Gamay, I think, planted maybe in Oregon. And it's been there. It's own rooted, so it's just on volcanic soil. It's been there. So we make it in a very traditional, Beaujolais style, carbonic maceration, all with whole cluster. And it's very drinkable and delicious.
I haven't tried it. I'm excited to try it.
Yeah.
And I have my notes. You dry farm.
You're
live certified. Live is a specific certification.
Yeah.
And are you biodynamic?
Yes,
are you shifted?
Yeah, since 2008. So,
do you plant that ram's horn in the soil somewhere?
You
follow the Steiner thing.
We did that in October, and then it's going to, when there's start of bud break, we're going to take it out, the horns empty, and just spray it in the vineyard. So it's,
you're a good person to ask this, because since I've been doing the show, the natural, organic, biodynamic wine movement is well on its way. We do the show out of Brooklyn, and there's a lot of bars dedicated to, just raw wines and wine stores. The first raw wine fair was in Brooklyn last fall and all of that. How does live certified biodynamic organic farming, how does it affect the taste of the grape?
It's 100%. It's
good.
Of course, you have to make the wine in the correct way also.
Right.
You can't expect the wine to just...
We're talking farming,
But farming, you create this amazing microflora and all this amazing organic matter in the soil.
Sustainability.
Which really gives the grapes a different kind of energy and different kind of vibrancy. Of course, if you make the wine in the correct way in the cellar without any manipulation and you make it that right way, the energy is unbelievable. You can taste it, you can feel
really
it.
You really
can. Oh, 100%. It's this. I don't want to get too geeky, but you can. It's proven scientifically. You can taste it. You can see it. You can see. You walk in the vineyard. You see all the worms in the vineyard. It's alive. I mean,
Would you? It almost sounds like it would be hard not to make wines that way now, if you could.
Yeah, you've had Pascaline here, and she's dedicated her entire life and, of course, her wine program to that sort of wine, and it's important. I think it's the only way for the future, because we have to sustain not only our bodies, but our vineyards,
the land,
what we eat, the bread, the vegetables, the meat, all these hormones, and...
It's great to have, advocates like you that practice that. And Pascaline and all. All right, we're going to take a quick break. My guest is Raj Parr, winemaker, former sommelier, all-around busy guy. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be back after these messages.
This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful, handcrafted agricultural journal. Each issue features stories about food history, seasonal recipes, artisanal products, and the amazing people who bring it to your table. Packed with stunning photography, the content is fresh and educational. Southern Farm and Garden takes you behind the scenes to meet farmers, gardeners, wineries, chefs, and artists who are passionate about creating healthy, unique, and sustainable food and products that you can enjoy all year. Are you interested in eating healthier and learning more about where your food comes from and living a more connected life? Subscribe today to southernfarmandgarden.com. Foodtank.com names Southern Farm and Garden one of the top 20 magazines for people who eat, cook, and grow, praising it for connecting readers with the food, the farms, and the stories behind our food system. Subscribe today or find a retailer near you at southernfarmandgarden.com.
All right, we're back with Raj Parr. We could go on a long time with Raj because he knows a lot about everything. But I want to subject him to my wine list because I'm curious what he's drinking and thinking. So, Raj, every week we ask our guests pretty much the same questions. And I want to get your take on all of this. So what are you drinking now? And I know you had 18 bottles of Cornas and, you know, we're at Burgundy La Pauli, but what's like, what are you trying or what have you been sort of leaning towards at home or curious about?
Yeah, here we are. So I guess it's snowing right now.
And, terrible.
And it's cold. So, of course, different wines for different occasions. But what I drink at home, I drink a lot of Beaujolais.
You like so, Beaujolais? Good everyday wine, good food everyday wine.
Yeah, great.
Crunchy, give me fresh. One or two good producers.
My favorite producer is Jean-Louis Dutrève.
Dutrave?
A-I-V-E.
A-I-V-E,
yeah,
Dutrève.
This amazing human being, amazing guy in Fleury. And of course, there's Lapierre. There's Foyard.
Foyard is spelled how?
F-O-I-L-L-A-R-D.
D, right. Those are good Beaujolais.
Yeah, and you know, it's a Gamay is a delicious grape, and all these producers make it in a very pure and natural way without any additives. And
so Beaujolais is what you're drinking now.
And yeah.
It's also a good all-around wine to have.
Yeah, and it's affordable, though it's getting expensive slowly, but it's still affordable.
If it was 90 degrees out and sunny, maybe we would have said a Chablis or something, but that makes sense for now.
Yeah, I think for in white grapes, I drink dry Riesling and, of course, Loire Valley, so Chenin Blanc.
Right.
For some reason, I've been drinking less Chardonnay in the last...
It's okay.
In the last few
it's
months.
All right. All right, give me your favorite wine and food pairing. Kind of a general question, but you got to look back and go back and more times than a few. You just love the fact that you have a bottle of this and you're eating that. What's a good food pairing for you? I'm not saying recommend.
Yeah, no.
What do you like?
You know, if people don't know me, my classic meal at home anywhere will be a green salad and roast chicken.
Okay.
You know, and
Zuni does a pretty good job.
Oh, yeah.
But what goes from what are you drinking with that?
You know, I love like Saint-Joseph. I love Syrah from the Northern Rhone, something which is crunchy and fresh and full of energy, you know. It's
Pierre Gonon. Oh, yeah.
You
met him, right?
I mean, yeah, the Gonon, yeah. He's a friend. He's amazing, amazing, amazing producer.
What's another?
You can also have, Jean-Louis Chave kind of a basic Saint-Joseph offerus, which is very affordable. And then he also makes an estate, a domain, Jean-Louis Chave.
So the Chave is a good, if you want to go on an expensive end, he makes a more of an entry. Good to know.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so roasted chicken salad and a little Rhone. That's a good.
Yeah, it's
that's a good wine and food pairing.
Yeah, at home I have a grill, so I
cook the chicken on the grill.
Yeah, it's a little Traeger grill.
It's a little more work.
Yeah.
At least you didn't say champagne or Muscadet oysters. I love you for that. even though that's good. All right, this is. We usually ask people this from where they're from, but you've been in and out of New York enough, and you know San Francisco as well as anyone. Give me your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. A restaurant that is great but has a good attention towards wine, too.
Oh, I think...
I think Pascaline and Patrick do it well. Maybe that's your... But
yeah, for sure.
Give me one for New York and give me one for San Francisco.
I think Rebel is a great example because the food is delicious.
One Michelin star chef.
You can eat there every day, and the wine list is incredible. It's deep, and it's you can buy a delicious $50 bottle of wine, or you can buy
crazy
$1,000-$2,000 bottle of wine. It's all there, and most of it is affordable. The markups are great, and Chef Daniel's food is
terrific.
You know, I could eat there a lot. So,
what about San Fran?
In San Francisco, my favorite restaurant in the whole world is Zuni Cafe.
Okay,
and they have a terrific wine list.
They do.
Oh yeah, it's really
is it as good as the food?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because, okay, I mean, you know, there's a famous steakhouse, Peter Luger's.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They have the worst crap wine list and the most famous steak.
No, the wine list is incredible. It's not a big wine list. It's small, well-curated.
Curated.
Yeah, you can drink, you know, Italian. You can drink German. You can drink, you know, Burgundy. It's really well-priced, and it's all there to have with your roast chicken.
So those are two good choices.
Yeah.
Now, I ask this question to everyone, but I don't always ask it to Raj Parr, so I'm curious about Raj Parr. Favorite all-time wine? What's the wine that moved you? And you can give me a couple if you have. But there's got to be... I mean, we could even classify it as the wine you drank with your uncle, the Burgundy, you know, with Larry, because those were life-changing. But there's got to be something that you think about, or a few.
I mean, there's many, but, you know, I mean, personally, it depends on where I am. I mean, my epiphany wine was Ravino Chablis Le Clos 86.
When did you drink that? Pretty close, like a few years after that? Or?
Yeah, I had it for the first time in 96.
Okay.
My friend Robert Bohr opened a bottle for me a couple years ago, so it's always...
It's terrific.
It's always special to revisit a wine which you started with 20 years ago.
So that's the Ravino...
Yeah.
What was
the... Chablis Le Clos. So
Le Clos, okay.
1986. You don't see the wine too often.
No. But that, I'm not asking for accessible, available wines or whatever.
Yeah, so that's something which is, you know, it's in my mind all times.
All right, that's a good one. Last question, and this helps my listeners, and you're going to have to juggle a little. Best wine under $15 retail that you know. Give me a red, give me a white. Can you think? If you're sending my son to the store, he's having a dinner party, he wants 3 bottles of wine, he's got 15, couple bucks more. What's he drinking on the red side? What's he drinking on the white side?
So I think for red, I think that, again, coming back to Gamay, I think, I'm not sure how much it costs, maybe a little bit more than 15. It's the Raison Gaulois. It's the Gamay from La Pierre. It's like the second
label. La Pierre is the maker?
Yeah.
L-A-P-P-I-E-R. Okay.
L-A-P-P-I-E-R-E.
Right.
And so they make a kind of a second label called Raison Gaulois. Which
spell the Gaulois for me.
It's Gaulois, I think.
E.
S-E?
Gaulois. Yes.
And yeah, so it's their kind of basic Gamay. I think it's around that price.
Between 15 and 20, and probably.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
so that's a great one. How about a white?
You know, of course, you have to go to the Loire. I think Muscadet, you come back.
Muscadet comes up more. It's a great wine for the money.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot of producers who make, you know, delicious, you know, it's a fresh wine. It's, of course, right now I can't think of it because it's snowing outside. But
I know. But like Marc Olivier,
Pepier is probably...
those are good.
Know,
those are value wines.
Yeah, I think under
20. So Muscadet over and over is really the white value wine. All right, good job on that. we post that on our site, so I'll tell you later. All right, we're talking to Raj Parr. We're going to wrap up the show in a little bit, but we're going to go into our weekly wine sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air. For our sip this week, I twisted Raj's arm and made him bring a wine in. Not because I wanted a free wine, but I really wanted a taste with Raj, and I wanted to feature one of his wines. So Raj, tell me, because you brought it in, I don't have the notes, tell me what we're drinking.
Yeah, so we have our Evening Land Seven Springs La Source Pinot Noir 2014. So this is an estate, very famous estate, which has been around since the mid-80s. And we acquired it in 2014. So we made this wine. This is our first wine from pruning to bottling. And
filling the room up.
Yeah, La Source is a single section of the estate. It's a wine which is very classic of Oregon, has that kind of cranberry smoky note. It has a little bit of the leathery kind of, you know, we use a whole cluster here, so And, you know, it really kind of shows the volcanic soil it's grown on. And it's in our style. You should taste it.
See, all right. So that's the setup and the description. So let's look at the color. Describe the color to me.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like a pale ruby red color. You know, it has probably like, you know, medium viscosity. It's, right. You know, if you smell it.
Let's talk about the nose.
Yeah, you know,
give me the descriptor.
You know, for me, it smells like, you know, raspberries and rhubarb and
red fruit,
cola.
Right.
A little bit of the smoky tone, which you get from the volcanic soil.
I like the smoky tone.
Yeah,
it gives it a little character.
Classic.
So it's got a full nose. When we poured it in the glass, it filled up the room, which is a nice thing. All right, so first thing, mouthfeel. Just describe to me.
Yeah, so similar kind of red fruits on the mouth.
No spitting.
Spicy.
Give me the mouthfeel. It's sort of a medium body.
Yeah, it's a medium light.
Not full, unctuous.
No, medium.
Not thin. It's
medium body.
Coating.
It's like biting into a crunchy cherry, crunchy raspberry kind of, a little bit of cola, some allspice kind of, you know, moderate tannins.
So tannins are moderate.
Moderate, yeah.
Okay. And you were getting into the taste descriptors.
Yeah, it's, you know, you can taste kind of that licorice and allspice on the palate, and you smell the rhubarb, slightly peppery also on the
little pepper.
Yeah, on the finish, you know, good freshness, good acidity. You know, it's moderate. The alcohol is quite modest, only 13.1. So
great.
It's pretty,
you know, level. I don't have a chance to ask a lot of people this because we taste wine every week. And at some point, I'll ask you what foods this pairs well with and, you know, if we like the wine. I like the wine, and certainly you're not going to say you don't because I know you picked a good one. But the question is, you set out to make a wine, and is this the representation you hoped for?
You know, we had no idea because it's our first vintage. So we didn't really have preconceived notion. We made the wine we know how to make, and luckily the vintage was favorable to us, you know, and the grapes came in great condition. We made the wine in the way we know, you know, just mostly whole bunches.
So are you happy with the style?
You couldn't be happier.
You couldn't be. Okay.
You know, it's our first vintage from a place we've never made wine before, so...
Right.
From a very heralded and famous vineyard. So it was definitely something which, it's all first time. So it's...
So this is the 2014 Evening Land La Source. La Source is the particular bottle. It's from the Seven Springs Estate. So let's talk about your wines and, you know, how we can get them. First on this wine... What's the availability?
We just released it now. So previous to this, the wine was only available through a mailing list.
Okay.
So it's...
And now it's at restaurants?
Yeah, so now it's going to be in restaurants.
Some retail?
Yes, absolutely. Retail shows for sure.
So it's because it's not, you know, how many cases did you make?
I mean, this is around 800 cases.
Right, so it's a fairly sought-after wine. It's a limited production. It's not going to be everywhere, but it is available retail. You will see it at better restaurants. And give me a retail price range. What are we drinking at?
This is 70.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Raj, you're going to get, you know, the best wines at a fair price. And this, you know, will compete with any Burgundy. So let's talk about, before we wrap up, how to get your wines.
Yeah.
Do we go vineyard by vineyard, sandi.com? Let's inform people.
So the Evening Land is elvwines.com.
Okay.
And then Sandi is Sandi.
S-A-N-D-H-I.
S-A-N-D-H-I wines.com.
.com.
And then Domain de la Cote.
Domain, D-O-M-A-I-N-E, de. D-E-L-A, code C-O-T-E,
.com. Yeah.
So each project is its separate project and winery. Each has its own website. Each one is, you know, there's a lot of explanation to who's involved, what they're doing. There's, you know, a wine section for buying, what's available at that point. prices and all of that. So if you're interested in any of Raj's wines, Sandy, Domaine de la Cote, Evening Land, even worst case scenario, you Google them and they'll show
up. Oh, you can just email me. Top of the thing. Always email me.
Or Raj. And you know, as somebody who's been drinking wine a long time, and obviously that's why I'm doing the show, Raj is making, you know, some of the best wines out there. So lastly, Raj, what would we pair this with? What's a good traditional pairing?
I think like game birds work really well, you know, like quail or a squab or... You know, something which is...
All right, so let's say you're me and you're not around a lot of game birds.
Or you're going to have...
Give me...
You can have anything. You can have buffalo wings with this. You can have fried chicken with this. You can
now you're talking.
You can have a pizza with this.
This goes well with any of that. It'll hold up to fried. It'll be great with a pizza.
Yeah.
Chicken wings. So don't be afraid to... This isn't, you know, it doesn't have to be some fancy...
No. Okay. You can just like, you know, you can... barbecue or something. It's a medium body wine, so it's not, you know, but you can have it with anything which is not too heavy.
Got it. And it is a delicious wine, and when you describe wines, it may not be the most technical term, but delicious is a damn good you know, compliment and all that. All right, we're going to wrap up, Raj. If you have a question, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation. Follow us on Facebook, The Grape Nation. On Instagram, it's @sbenruby. And on Twitter, it's @benruby, without the S. I want to thank my guest, Rajat Parr, winemaker at Sandy, Domaine de la Cote, and Evening Land, Seven Springs, for coming in. Raj is on a fierce schedule. He's in for La Paulie. He's got the three wineries. He's an educator. He told you he's writing a book. So Raj isn't sitting home, so... It was a pleasure to have him here. I thank you, Raj, for coming
in. Thanks, Sam. Thanks. Great to be here.
Thanks to our engineer, Vitor, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Benruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.